A core theme of the people and ideas that we study on this show are the folks who have crafted genuinely unique career paths for themselves. My guest today, Kevin Van Ekeren, is precisely that type of person. He moved from training members of the SWAT team to running his own sustainable organic farm. He also does angel investing and hosts his own podcast, has a really varied background with a wide range of experiences that is very interesting and admirable for me. And he has a lot of wisdom to share through the telling of his own story and journey through entrepreneurship. So make sure you're taking notes and paying attention to my interview with Kevin Van Ekeren.
You're listening to Going Deep with Aaron Watson.
So, Kevin, thank you so much for coming on my show, man. I'm excited to be talking to you today.
I'm so excited to be here.
I want to kick things off with something of a controversial topic related to guns in America, police tactics. It's one of those things that gets sprayed into the news and immediately elicits an emotional response for most people. It's the news topic du jour. It can be very divisive. And that is an industry in which you have been associated with, worked for a while, and actually started a company that was meant to serve the training of SWAT teams. And the realization that you came to is that properly training or better training for these tactical units actually reduced the use of violence and increased outcomes, just improved the security for everyone involved. And I'm really curious, as a starting point, what type of, I don't know if you want to call them training shortcomings or additions, that your company and you were looking to make to the training of these high-skilled technical units, and how you were addressing that market.
Sure. So To start off this whole thing, it's important to understand that I was a civilian on a SWAT team, and my job was to professionalize the SWAT team. So I was straight out of college, and one of the big things I realized was that cops revert to training in high-stress situations because you have to react automatically. You have to react very quickly. And so what I also realized was that if the training wasn't there, then their reactions were not proper. Meaning, we got them an armored vehicle, and I saw them running between what was possibly a gunman in a house and the armored vehicle. And some of these people have master's degrees and are extremely bright. But in that moment of I might be getting shot at, your reptilian brain, the most basic part of you, takes over, and you need to instill training into that more basic part of your brain. And so what we did at Fulcrum Tactical was to basically use stress inoculation. That is to put them in what they perceive to be a dangerous situation, although it is not a dangerous situation. And by doing that over and over again, one, they react less severely. They lose less minor motor skills and all that during high stress situations. But secondly, they revert to the training that we provided far more than they revert to something they learned in a classroom. And that is what drove us to realize that this is the right way to train. But also, many studies have been done to prove that the more training an officer goes through, the less likely they are to use force at all. And very rarely will a well-trained police officer use excessive force.
Yeah, and these are such, you know, high stress situations. Reminds me of a quote actually by the Greek poet Archilochus: "We don't rise to the level of our expectations; we fall to the level of our training." And you know, longtime listeners of this show know I have an extensive background in ultimate frisbee. Mine's much more sports related as opposed to, you know, security forces. It's a different world, but that same biological response to stress. I've seen it many times on the field where players who you've coached up fall back into their old habits, into their own old tendencies in the biggest games, in the biggest moments. They know their one thing that they can do well and fall back to that. So it's really important not only to, you know, seek out the training, but to recognize that reality in yourself and not just in others, and cross that bridge, which is not easy to cross, of reprogramming some of your most basic reactions and basic thought processes in those high stress situations. Can you talk at all about how folks that came in reacted to that training? It seems like that's a profession where they're used to accessing different trainings, but was there a different response given the way you were presenting the information or putting them into these situations?
I think the big thing that every cop is skeptical. And they have to be. Everyone lies to them. Everyone wants to get away with something, all that. They meet most people on their worst day. So we had to go in and prove ourselves first to be competent. And thankfully, I had, you know, one of the grandfathers of modern SWAT, and he doesn't like me saying that because it makes him sound as old as he is. But he was brilliant, and he was one of the leaders in changing how SWAT works. So that name, that presence helped get us in the door, but then we had to prove it. And so often in these classes, you'll see the first few days, they're skeptical and you have to prove yourself to them. By the last few days, these guys are so pumped because they're already seeing big changes. And the big changes that really drove change for us as a company, as a brand, was that we were getting not just local law enforcement, but federal agencies coming back to us time and time again, and then recommending us to other agencies simply on one or two trainings. And that's something that most people just can't accomplish. So we definitely found the right mix of having enough of a celebrity and a really, you know, amazing expert, and also altering the way training works to give everyone the best benefit. But also, we did it for a very cheap price. And that was another big component to our success.
Yeah, that's a dynamic combo if you can provide excellent service at a reasonable price. What attracted you to SWAT and security and this general industry initially?
Well, honestly, when I was a kid, I grew up in kind of an upper middle class neighborhood, but I was always being pulled over. And I didn't understand why. And I really thought it was because I was young and I was driving a red car. You could call it a sports car, even though it was a total hunk of crap. And later I realized I was just driving like an idiot and I should have been pulled over all those times. But what I realized is that if I'm going to get over this fear I have of the police, I need to understand them. And so I started studying criminal justice in college. Then I did my first ride-along and just fell in love with it. The camaraderie, the brotherhood, and the fact that you get to help people every single day are just phenomenal things about being a police officer. The long-term stresses are not for me. You know, the working shift work and constantly dumping adrenaline into your system combined with large periods of boredom, it's not for me long-term. But it was certainly fun for the 7-8 years that I participated in it.
Which leads me to the follow-up question. After, you know, getting this business of tactical training, Fulcrum tactical training off the ground, you then switched into farming. I may be skipping a step there, but those to me seem as diametrically opposed as possibly be in terms of industries. You talked about that fast pace, real high intensity. The farming seems like, correct me if I'm wrong, more of a monotonous slog more often than not. Tell me about the connection there or how you ended up collecting duck and quail eggs.
Sure. So I was working 50, 60 hours a week as a civilian, both with the SWAT team, but also with a bunch of other local law enforcement agencies. And then I was working another 40, 50 hours running my company, Fulcrum Tactical. And I was just overstressed and overwhelmed. And I decided that I needed a place to relax. And so this is in the bottom of the ag market over back in 2010. And I bought a few acres and just started. I figured, well, I have land. I'm a redneck. I might as well have a little bit, a few chickens. Got 28 chickens. And it grew from there. A local restaurant ended up popping up that I really like the owners. I really like what they're doing. And I was really happy to be a part of helping them succeed. And so, you know, they're our biggest customer to this day. And really, it turned into my way of enjoying the time I have and living a little bit in the moment instead of constantly working on business or trying not to get shot.
Absolutely. And one of the things you mentioned in the description of this farm is that it's sustainable farming. Can you talk a little bit about your definition of that term and how you go about making practices of making your farm sustainable?
Absolutely. So we use no pesticides, herbicides, inorganic fertilizers, all that stuff. That's the first key to that. The second is to understand the nitrogen cycle. That is to say, if we put chickens or ducks or pigs or whatever on a piece of land, they're going to go about munching on the grass and eating the bugs and going to the bathroom. Well, you don't want to over-contaminate that land with nitrogen, which is their poop, right? And so we have to cycle animals on and off land properly. You also have to make sure that you have all the right plants growing in that pasture that can properly absorb that nitrogen so it doesn't get dumped into the water table or as runoff into a stream or pond. And then to go even further than that, we don't use any antibiotics. We don't use any confinement of any kind, meaning they only come in at night, and during the day they're out and doing their thing like they should be. And then finally, we give them a huge amount of space. Typically, each bird has about 10 square feet per bird inside and about 100 square feet at least per bird outside. And we do the same for pigs and all that kind of stuff on a grander scale because they're even bigger animals. So that's kind of our philosophy.
I dig it. In terms of reinventing yourself or really kind of transitioning to a new stage, I'm sure you're involved with security and Fulcrum Tactical to some degree or another, but turning over a new leaf, building a new skill set, throwing yourself into a new world in which you're uncomfortable is something I admire, something that all of my favorite people, whether I'm following them or their family, friends, they have that nature to themselves. Was it a difficult decision to throw yourself into that? Did it kind of just hook you and you almost didn't have a choice? What was that experience like of, you know, learning these farming skills that probably weren't part of your previous day-to-day?
Well, it's interesting you talk about that because for me, if I'm not learning something new, then I feel like I'm dying a little bit. So I believe in being a holist over an anatomist. So for those of you who don't know, an anatomist studies a branch of a tree in a forest, and a holist studies the forest as a whole. And so, you know, I studied psychology and criminal justice and finance and everything I could in college so that I could be the best business person I could be and the best person overall that I could be. Same with going in from tactical training to farming was I wanted to explore this and understand where our food came from. So one, I could better the system, and two, I could understand what I was consuming. And that has kind of continued into investing and everything else that I do as well.
Have your eating habits changed significantly as a result of owning a farm?
I would say about 30% of the food I consume comes from the farm. And that's just because we're in Illinois, so we don't produce vegetables and fruits year-round. But I usually, at least one protein source a day comes from my farm.
Gotcha. Cool. You hinted at, you mentioned the investing. It would not be a complete conversation if we didn't touch on that, given how popular of a topic that is for us on this show. You do some angel investing, actually a part of the Hyde Park Angel Investors, a venture firm. Tell me a little bit about how you got involved in angel investing. My perception is that often once someone has achieved a certain level of success with their first or their collection of businesses, the solicitations slowly start coming in for other aspiring entrepreneurs, people who are looking to raise money. I'm sure that that was a part of it, but is it something that you went out and sought, or did it find its way to you?
Well, I actually made my first investment in a business when I was only 26. And I've been investing on the side the entire time with people like Hyde Park Angels. But now I have my own fund called Fulcrum Investing. And this is now a full-time venture for me. So I think that the big thing that I realized going from Fulcrum Tactical to co-founding seven other companies to starting my farm and then eventually starting Fulcrum Tactical is that really business is business is business. And yes, you need to learn the ins and outs, but as an investor and an advisor to any business, I can usually help whatever business it is without really knowing the industry, because the CEO and his team or her team is going to be the experts. They're going to say that technique really isn't valid in this industry, or it is or it's not or whatever. Whereas I'm just looking to provide, you know, support for my investments. And that's why I also have a team of seven other people to accomplish that in a very effective way.
Gotcha. Is there a specific niche or a collection of industries that you focus on? Sounds like you feel like you can have a hand in most businesses, but is there any in particular that you focus on related to an expertise?
No, actually, that's why I have a team of seven other people. Because I wanted to invest in the widest array of industries possible, because in my opinion, that's what makes a good investment portfolio. Whereas if I just invested in tech, for example, and we had another tech bubble or whatever, that presents more risk in my opinion.
As we aim towards wrapping up here, Kevin, I'm curious if there's any other takeaways. You know, our audience tends to be a little bit younger, tends to be a little bit earlier in their, whether they're entrepreneurs or somewhere in the business world of building their careers. When you look back at the successes and failures that you've had, is there anything you could, any piece of advice you wish you could give yourself when you were in your early to mid 20s?
Yes, that would be to do your research. And when I say that, I mean, don't have an opinion until you go out and do your research. Hop on Google and check that the source that you're getting this information is actually credible. There are so many times I have gone down a road of either looking to start a business or make an investment or make a personal decision in my life just to find out that the fact that I made the decision on was not actual fact. And that actually led me down so many wrong paths that it got me angry enough to actually start my own podcast called The State of Logic. And our entire goal is to give our audience a different perspective and to ask them to go out and do their own research and come to their own informed conclusions, whatever those are. And so from that end of things, I think that really owning the fact that you are in charge of your own opinion, and if you don't take the time to do the research and check your sources and all that, then you can't be angry with someone when they call you out for having incorrect information.
Are there any particular instances where you got burned, like a specific example that you remember?
Absolutely. I invested in a company very early on having to do with real estate. They were buying agricultural land, basically, and the claim was that the ag land price had never been this low before, and it was a once in a lifetime opportunity. That one simple thing I took their word on, and it turns out that at this time it hadn't even hit a 5-year low, and the opportunity was actually coming 18 months later. And so they bought all their land way too high. And then by the time the land had recovered as far as price goes, they had, you know, they were out of business and they could just sell the land and just pay their investors back, barely. And that was one of those things where if I had paid attention, I would have caught that and I wouldn't have made that investment.
Absolutely. Well, that's a great example to learn from. And that, you know, I think it's a Ronald Reagan expression, trust but verify. You don't want to go through life exclusively skeptical of other people. I think you mentioned with the police officers, they get a lot of people lying to them on a regular basis. So it's very understandable that their biases may lay in that direction, but definitely good to cover your bases and double check everything. Kevin, this has been great. I want to make sure that people can connect with you, check out the podcast and all the other cool stuff you're doing. What digital coordinates can we point people towards to learn more about you and connect?
Absolutely. The easiest way is to go to thestateoflogic.com. You can email us from there. You can sign up for our newsletter and all that other good stuff right from that page. That's the best. You can also check out my farm at Fulcrum Farm on Instagram. And I'm always doing live casts and posting pictures of animals and all that good stuff. And I'm more than happy to answer any questions you guys may have in whatever realm may help you.
Cool. Definitely some cool pictures of goats up over there. I encourage everyone to check it out here. Before we let you go, Kevin, as we do at the end of every episode of Going Deep, I want to give you the mic one final time to issue an actionable personal challenge to the audience.
Yeah, I personally would challenge everyone listening to go out and set a goal of what time of day you're going to set aside every single day to try and figure out what your next step is in your life. Plan that, make that 3, 5, 10, 20 year plan and work every day to execute on it. And that way, when your time comes, you know you did everything you could to have a long and fruitful life.
Absolutely. And it's training for your brain to think in the long term. It's really easy to fall into the habit, into the pattern of just focusing on the very next thing, looking in the short term. But that long-term vision will pay off, as it clearly has if you have all your success in different companies. Once again, thank you so much for coming on Going Deep with Aaron Watson and sharing your time with us today.
Thank you so much. And I also want to say that I've really enjoyed the podcast and all the episodes I've listened to. So please keep up the great work, because you're helping the community as well.
Thanks, man. We just went deep. I hope everyone out there has a fantastic day. Hey, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Going Deep with Aaron Watson. Please hit subscribe if you've not already done so. We've got a large back catalog of other investors and financial gurus. So head on over to goingdeepwithaaron.com/finance to find those interviews and just a pathway to discovering many, many more interesting interviews that we've had on the show, including game-changing entrepreneurs. But down the pipe, we have a couple of fun interviews, including one on the benefits of travel. A fellow Pittsburgh podcaster shares her story of a near-death experience and what she learned from that. Many other interesting conversations and a lot of fun to be had. So make sure you're staying tuned to Going Deep with Aaron Watson.
Thanks for listening. Connect with Aaron on Twitter and Instagram at AaronWatson59.